This is MetaDama, a holistic view on data management in the Nordics. Welcome, my name is Winfried and thanks for joining me for this episode of MetaDama. Our vision is to promote data management as a profession in the Nordics, show the competencies that we have, and that is the reason I invite Nordic experts in data and information management for a talk. Welcome to today's episode of MetaDama. And I'm really excited to talk to Umer today. He is the lead for data science at Ruter. And everyone who lives in Oslo or the area knows Ruter as the public transport service that is provided. And we're going to talk about artificial intelligence in the transport, but also about sustainability and how can we use artificial intelligence to create more sustainability when it comes to, for example, fleet optimization. But Umer is going to talk a lot more about that. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Winfried. Very nice to be on the show.
And very nice to have you. I think we could start with you giving us a quick introduction to who are you?
Yeah, so I guess you already explained a bit, but I can just jump into it. My name is Umer, and I'm the head for data science, artificial intelligence, and data warehouse departments at Ruter. We're not really that big team. We are like 26 persons. In addition to Ruter, I have another job. So I'm also an assistant professor at Oslo Met. So I teach artificial intelligence to bachelor level students. And in addition to that, I'm also the founder and the CTO for my startup, Binaric. We are a data labeling company. And in addition to that one, I also am the founder of Offently AI. That was a network of people who work in Offently companies based in Norway who are working with AI. That was a very quick summary of who I am.
With all the work you're doing, is there any free time left?
Yeah, so I would, if you're talking about the hobby part, I'm a very boring person. I don't have any hobbies. So, I mean, I have a beautiful son, and that is the free time I have. I spend a lot of time with him, so I really enjoy that.
Oh, that was fantastic. Yeah, family is so important. And I think my hobby is the podcast. So it's kind of interlinked, isn't it?
Correct. That is correct.
So where does your interest for data come from? How did you get started in the field?
Well, that was my first job when I graduated from Kungliga Tekniska Högskolan in Stockholm. The first job I got was in Google, and then I jumped over to a telecom company in Stockholm, CNET. And that's when I started working with data warehousing, data reporting. And that's when that was my first introduction to data while working as a programmer.
So you really work with data bottom up?
Well, it varied. So half of my career has been programming, software programming, and the remaining half was data warehousing, business intelligence, reporting, data architecture, and all of those things. And then, I mean, with data, it's linked to artificial intelligence because 80% of AI, 80% of work we do in AI is data. So then it was a natural evolution of my job that it was like, okay, will you work with data on the article side as well? So why not work with AI now? So that's how the whole career started.
And this is a really interesting topic, because every time I talk to people about their careers and data, it's all interlinked.
And it is interlinked, yeah.
And data is just such a broad field. There's so many, in DEMA we call it knowledge areas, but there's so many different topics that you can dig really deep into. And it's so important to have some way of trying to connect all of that and have a holistic picture. I would love to hear more about Offently AI. Yeah. What is that?
So the idea for Offently AI started 5 years ago. I was working at Skattetaten as an architect. We saw that around 5 years ago, again, there was a boom in AI. Everyone around us was talking about AI. Everyone wanted to work with AI, but everyone had the same problems. Like, the problems were very simple. How do you get started with AI? And then it became more complex. GDPR, data regulations, ethical AI, explainable AI. Well, explainable AI wasn't really that popular back then. And ethics was also a subject people were talking about. But people, what asking the same questions and they needed help. So when you are living in Norway, it's a kind of a community where often companies are very strong. In US, for example, tech companies are very strong. Private companies are very strong. In Norway, it's the opposite. It's a lot of businesses generated by Offentlig companies. And then you have consultancies giving business to all those Offentlys. So if you want to look for a lot of new adaption of new technologies comes from Offentlig companies as well. So then we started talking to other Offentlig companies and we realized that the forefront of companies working with AI in Norway were Offentlig companies. So we're looking at Skattetaten, NAV, Forsvaret, intelligence services, for example. So I proposed that, and these Offentlig companies, they find it easier to talk to other Offentlig companies. So Skattetaten can easily talk to NAV, but they might find it harder to talk to a private company because there's a breach of, there's a competition. A private company might try to sell them something. So we established a forum where all these Offentlig employees of these Offentlig companies can talk about problems with AI, discuss their use cases, discuss their data, and see how things go. And the response was really great. It's been 5 years since we have established Offentlig AI. It's a community-run thing. And now we are like 25-plus companies who are members of that community, and we are 150 people, even more than that, who are part of this community. And we meet every 2 or 3 times a year. The last meeting we have was at NAV, and NAV was not nice enough to host it. And so we exchange ideas, we ask questions, we ask. Now the biggest thing on our mind is about the new EU directive on AI, which will impact us the way we work. So we're talking about that.
Really interesting and impressive numbers. So many organizations that joined in and so many people. So it's really a topic that obviously affects people.
Correct. Yeah, it does actually.
And I have to agree with you on there's a difference between Norway and the US when it comes to who is leading up the field of technological development, but also development of new ideas, new processes in data. This is something I also realized facilitating the Norwegian data mesh community. There, it's also the public sector in Norway that is front runners, like, for example, NAV, as you mentioned.
Yeah, they are the ones who are investing a lot into digitization as well. So then it becomes very natural that a lot of innovation is also coming from their side. So I'm not saying that private companies are not doing anything as well. I mean, if you look around you, there's a lot of interesting tech companies, private companies who have done a lot of great stuff. Ooda, for example, they have done a lot of good stuff in AI and data as well. And now the landscape is totally different. You have multiple small actors doing a lot of interesting stuff. So things are changing in Norway as well. But I mean, Offentlys are still very powerful here.
I'm happy that you mentioned Ooda because that's the link to the previous episode. So,
I heard that.
So let's talk a bit about the public transportation sector. You came from Skattetaten or tax office and moved over to Ruter. How do we use data in public transportation?
Well, public transportation is a bit complex because we don't have data coming in from one source. Okay, so let's break it down. So let's take on a very simple example. When you are taking the bus, as soon as you enter the bus and you look around you, you might see there are sensors inside the door as you enter the door. Or there might be sensors all placed all around the bus, actually. And those sensors, a bus can have minimum 20 sensors, and it can actually have more sensors than that. And we have, I don't have the number how many buses we have for Ruter, but we have a very smart team who is actually getting the data real time from all those buses. So every sensor on the bus is sending us real time data. So that's the data we get directly from our own transport means. Then we have data coming from boats, maybe we have data coming from trains. So trains is managed by Spoolvine. They're sending us that data. That's like the external parties who are involved. We then have some collaboration with external partners. So we have data coming in from Oslo Commune, Viken Commune. We have data coming in from Vegvesenet. There's a huge amount of modeling being done, which needs to predict how many people. Another analysis team is working with that it needs to predict how population is moving around, what will be the impact of moving population. So there are massive amounts of data coming in from huge players, Vegvesenet, Spoolvine, and then there are also very small international players, which are not based in Norway. So it's not one source of data. It's like multiple sources of data. And then now we recently launched our app, Ruter app, not that recently, but we have data coming in from over there. We ask people about their feedback. We accumulate data from them. We have our internal systems. We have some external systems. So there's massive amounts of data coming in. Then you have social media.
So with so much data and also so much external data from partners and vendors and external parties, there's probably a lot of different values that you get in, a lot of different levels of quality. How are you working with, and now I'm starting with the data management part because this is a DEMA podcast, right? But how are you working with data management in Ruter?
So the way we work with data management, previously we used to have a centralized team, which was managing all the data quality. Well, centralized team, the real-time team had this own, they were managing their own data quality. And then you had the data warehouse, which was managing their own data quality. And then there used to be a collaboration between the teams, and the architects used to make sure that, okay, these are the processes and these are the requirements you have to make sure. And this is the data you get in, this is the quality you have to maintain. Now we are going away from that approach from those central teams and entering into the data mesh way of working, where teams are responsible for consuming the data and then producing data and also need to make sure the quality on that data. That has obvious advantages because then you, instead of one team being the bottleneck, you now have transferred the responsibility. But then, of course, data mesh also creates its own challenges. And the challenge we are facing right now is how to do collaboration between those teams. And of course, you need to have architects who can actually talk across those teams, enforce policies and standards. Yeah, so Ruter right now is going through an organizational change where we are going towards the direction of some sort of data mesh kind of implementation. But we already have those centralized teams currently doing their work.
So we had a data mesh meetup earlier about federated computational data governance and how one could do that. And what was obvious was that there is a balance to strike or a challenge between, on the one side, scalability that you reach through meshing your data structure. On the other side, there's something about complexity. So if you go into a mesh, you go into raise the complexity of your organization. How do you tackle that challenge?
Oh, it is. The complexity will be increased. The number of people working in a team will increase. Responsibility on a team will also increase. And yeah, going to data mesh is not an easy solution. It actually raises a few other challenges as well. But then it also, I mean, of course, you need to weigh the benefits against the challenges, because right now the solution which most of the companies have is a very centralized solution. And when it comes to those centralized solutions, one team having the ownership of the whole data-driven concept of the organization, they cannot really fulfill that. So then every solution will have their own challenges. As I said, like, we have not really implemented the whole data mesh philosophy yet. So the actual challenges which you're talking about, they haven't really happened to us.
Yeah, we did an earlier episode on demand side data management. So how can we ensure that we have a certain customer focus on the work we are doing throughout the value chain? And me personally, I think this is going to be easier in a mesh. Challenges to it, obviously, but it's going to be easier because you have the people who are more direct in contact with the customer also making the decisions on the data and maintaining that customer focus.
But don't you think it will increase the complexity of hiring more people? You'll have to have more people in every team.
Definitely. That will increase the complexity, but it makes it also easier to ensure that the data products you are delivering for each domain have the right focus, the right quality, fit for purpose for that domain.
I'll try to supplement that by giving you another example. So I used to teach, 4 years ago, I used to teach software architecture and frameworks. And what we used to focus on was moving away from a monolith architecture, client-service architecture, to making microservices application. And all of my students were used to working with Java, and they used to make like client-server application. And then I taught them how to make microservices and how those microservices would communicate with each other. And it was, the whole concept was very easy working with microservices. But when they started creating microservices, they soon realized that it was super complicated to maintain all those microservices. It's very nice business-wise to divide them down in a business application. But then the maintenance department, like instead of one person working with the whole application, now you needed two or three persons. One person who has to manage these applications, microservices, and make sure that if one service goes down, the other is other. How does to have a back over and something like that? So what I'm trying to say is that it depends on how the scope of the company who's trying to implement it. If a company is small, data mesh is, I guess data mesh might not be the answer. But if a company is medium size or larger, then yes, data mesh could be the answer for them.
And this was a great example because we talked about public sector in Norway being front runners also when it comes to data mesh. And one who was really vocal about data mesh has been NAV. NAV is a company that has a microservice structure implemented. So the transition towards data mesh might be shorter.
And NAV is doing a lot of nice thing in these areas. You're right. So I guess a lot of people are looking up to NAV.
But let's get back to public transport and router. So what do you think is the most important element for success with data and AI for router?
There were two factors which help us a lot in succeeding with both data and AI. One was, especially for AI part, it was having end-to-end responsibility for the whole operation, for the whole management of the AI algorithm. So in some companies, the hierarchy is too big. So there's one set of team creating the algorithm and this one set of team working with the data, second team working with the algorithm, and third set of team actually deploying it. We cut away that hierarchy part and there was one team doing the data part, the AI part, and the deployment part. So that meant like less time for development of the product and then a tighter integration with the business side. When it comes to data and AI both, we don't work with PUCs. PUC is a very well-known thing to do when you're working with AI. And it's nice to do when you're learning AI. But when it comes to business, it's PUCs is not something which can give any value. So we look at immediate need, which can be solved if we see like, if for example, if we go around the organization, this is something we do every year. We identify a list of projects which needs to be done. And then we identify the one which will give them the most value if it was solved by using data and AI. And then we work with that one. And all of our projects has been in production and being used by a lot of users.
That was really interesting because I just recently had a chat about PUCs, and that proof of concept has been something that has gained traction a lot. People are doing proof of concepts, even though they already decided on implementing the solutions. So it's not really a proof of concept then anymore, but it's easier to get funding. It's easier to explain. Also, if you don't succeed with a proof of concept, then if you would implement it directly. And this is kind of not really a good way of doing it. Because it would be much easier to also create losses and lessons learned by just doing what you are supposed to do without calling it a proof of concept, right?
Yeah, I think for us, for anyone, I would say that the easy part, if you're working with AI or data, is making that algorithm. That's the easy part. Now, when you think about deploying it to production, then you need to have a team who can monitor that model and also give some value back to the user, integrated with our existing value chain. That's the hardest part. So the actual part of AI starts after you are done creating the AI. How can you use it to give value to the users?
Last question about public transportation in general. And you already mentioned it. There's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of different players, a lot of partners, a lot of other parties that you have to collaborate with in one way or another, even if it's like the trains, or if it's taxis or Ubers. Or how do you do that? How do you collaborate effectively with partners and others in the sector?
So in transport, there's a protocol called ITXPT. A lot of transport companies are already using that protocol, and this protocol actually makes it easier for transport companies to exchange data between each other on the same format. And when it comes to actually asking for data, we just enter into agreements with these companies. Most of them are often companies based in Norway, and then We have actually data agreements with a few of them. For some of them, we pay a certain price and we get the data from them. And the same thing goes the other way around as well. But when it comes to international players, it becomes more harder because the Norwegian government has a directive that all Authently companies should expose their data more. And of course, we have to follow those rules. So when we talk about international players like Uber or Google or Apple, for example, it's harder to get data from them because they don't share any of their data at all. So yeah, we don't have any collaboration with them. But for smaller players, yes, we have collaboration.
That public sharing of information is a known topic in itself. So I don't want to open a can of worms here, but there's a lot of different aspects to it. And I think Norway has done an enormous job on enabling public companies to share their data publicly and maybe building a quite good infrastructure to do that on.
I think Norway is the forefront when it comes to actually the policies, what you use, the technology which you're going to use and direction, the processes. It's very much ahead.
So sustainability and AI, how does it fit together?
The way it fits together is how can you use artificial intelligence algorithms to make your city more sustainable? So I can start off by giving you an example. One of the projects we did was to predict the capacity, how many people would be going in our buses on a specific time. And the algorithm which we made is a capacity prediction algorithm. So this is able to predict the capacity 3 days in advance, but we can also tweak it and it can predict to a month in advance. But right now the prediction we have is 3 days in advance. And we use this capacity in our app and we show people how people can actually plan their trips. The other use case, which is more affecting the sustainable part, is that if we already know how the capacity will be 3 days in advance, we have an operations team which actually is getting live data whenever there's a peak in traffic. So when they see like the peak is happening, they send more bus or more transport to that specific stop and try to decrease the load. Now, the way we can make it more sustainable is use a capacity prediction and plan in advance. Like we know in the future that the capacity will be higher on these stops. So then instead of sending four buses, we can send only two on that specific stop. So thereby, we're reducing the number of buses which will be running on the roads and making the whole environment more sustainable. So that is one example. The other example is fleet management. We have a bestilling transport service by Ruter. And Ruter is trying to go into the domain of ordering a bus. So like we have like any other transport company, we are a transport company. So people, there's a designated stop, you have to go to a stop. And then you go to your place. But our vision, long-term vision, is that you are sitting in your house and you order a service, and just like a taxi, a bus will come to your door and they will pick you up and take you wherever you want to go. So we already have a solution, but this solution is only for older people. I think 67 plus years and older. And this is being tested out in Viken area. What happens is that people go to their app, they order a bus, the bus will come to their home, pick them up and take them wherever they want to go. And then, yeah, so you don't have to pay anything extra. The ticket you have today, you can order it through that one. Now, one of the problems we had is that when there were no orders coming into that service, the drivers were free to go wherever they wanted to go. So they could stop at a petrol pump, they could even stop close to one of the customers, or they could go down and stop somewhere else. So we created an algorithm which was managing based on the historical orders we received. We then predicted where the new order will come from. So now when a driver is free, we position that person, that bus, close to the house or the area where we think the next order will come in. So then the buses are not driving that much. It's improving the sustainability part. And it's also making the customers more happy because they don't have to wait longer before the bus actually shows up.
This is an entirely interesting concept. So if you have the buses on route, it's quite predictable, but also quite predictable when it comes to capacity. But if you have those ordering services, the order can come from from basically from wherever in the area. So it's really hard to predict the route beforehand. How do you work with that?
So everything is based on historical information. We have data from 6 months ago. So, you know, in statistics, it's very easy to predict how a group of people will behave, and it's harder to predict how one person, how one individual person will behave. I mean, we have the data from the last 6 months, and we've been observing how the orders. So when we saw, when our algorithm produced a prediction of 3 days advance, we do a 3 days advance prediction. We know in 3 days in advance where the orders will come from. And the prediction score is almost 95% accurate. So it's a huge accuracy. And we know where the orders will be coming from. So we just place the buses. And this is based on what has happened before. But we also combine it with weather information. So if what we found was that if it's cold, people, older people especially, do not really like to go out. So then we don't have so many orders coming in. But when it's warm, then they would like to go out.
So the entire service is also more of a service that goes towards taxi services, right? Where they have pre-ordered quantas of people that they drive to or from hospitals, right? How is that new field evolving into the business model of Router?
So if you're talking about distilling transport, that is one area. Whereas, we are definitely looking into how this can be incorporated into the core business. But Router is a very interesting company because you don't have one. So of course, we have one offering, which is like to be able to provide or take a person from point A to point B. And then we have multiple services which we offer in that area. So we are thinking of how to incorporate this into our core business as well.
Now, since we are talking about sustainability, we kind of have to talk about a different perimeter, and that is energy consumption or the energy used by driving the buses. How can you optimize that on the route or on the ordering service?
That is a very good question. I think I'm not the right person to answer that. There's a special department which works with this one.
So we talked about that data provides the possibility to optimize resources in general. Of course, we can predict certain behaviors beforehand. But what more potential do you see when it comes to sustainability?
Oh, there's a lot. Data can actually... from Ruta's point of view, the very obvious benefits, the best thing Ruta did was to move away from fossil fuels to actually electrical buses. And that is something which you can see immediately. And the effect is also very visible. Like you have cut down the carbon footprint by going from fossil to fossil free. But the buses itself, I mean, there's a huge business around operating. There's a huge operation around how you operate the bus itself, how you manage your customers, how you provide the service to them, how much time you're spending on the bus, how much electricity you are using. If the electricity being wasting, to come back to your question as well, how much electricity is being used or not. There are so many elements which can be transformed by looking at the data. One project we did was using customer insights from our customer complaints. I mean, like any other customer facing company, we also get complaints from our customers. We took that data, all the complaints we ever received, and we used some artificial intelligence on it. We did some sentiment analysis on it. We tried to see how angry or how happy our customers were. If you take the time to write something to Ruta, you probably are pissed. So you won't be writing anything nice. You probably have a problem and you want customer service to resolve it. So we know that a lot of people who are writing to us are already angry. But within that scale, we wanted to see how angry people were. And we used like a sentiment analysis model to see how angry or how happy customers are in that aspect. And based on that data, we were able to identify people who were talking about a specific problem. And these were two problems which were interesting in their own aspect, because one of the group of customers were talking about the temperature inside the bus being too high. And this made us, by looking at this data, it made us to focus on those specific buses where the problem was coming up and fix those issues. And the second problem, which customers were complaining about, they were saying that they were complaining about the music issues inside the bus. So they were saying, when we drilled more and we highlighted, like, why are people complaining about the music inside the bus? So people said, like, they were not happy. Either the the sound was too high inside the buses, or the choice of the bus driver on the music wasn't really that good. So they were complaining about that. So some of the insights were very interesting.
Those are fantastic examples. Thank you. So there's another aspect I wanted to talk about. And we had an episode on trustworthy AI earlier. There's a lot of talk about responsible AI, but you bring in another term here, which is explainable AI. So what is, can you explain what explainable AI means?
Sure. Explainable AI is that artificial intelligence is like statistics on steroids. So artificial intelligence uses the same concepts as statistics and probability. What we have done is we have taken the same thing and we have combined it with immense power. And through algorithms, we can now use a lot of data and then use the same concept of statistics and probability to create an output. The thing is that it's hard to explain how a probability output is achieved. And that makes artificial intelligence a black box. So when programmers are working with AI algorithms, it's very hard for them to say how an algorithm reached or created a decision. General programming is easy. You have a set of instructions and you know exactly how the program created that output. AI is harder. So this gave birth to an area called explainable AI. And what happens in explainable AI is that developers create a set of tools and applications which can give insight into different factors on how a decision was achieved by an AI algorithm. So we did the same in Ruta. So we made our internal tools. What these tools do is they do an audit of the application. We have an algorithm running in a production. So it controls and audits as every time it makes a prediction. It then matches that prediction with the original estimate. It then tries to see what kind of data was used. Was this data changed or not? How many variables were we using? So this is more of an audit control of, you could call it like a model monitoring tool. And that is actually what we're doing when it comes to explainable AI. And I mean, with the new directives coming up, with new data senior oversight and EU's oversight, it's a requirement that all companies should be able to, all companies working with a specific kind of algorithm should be able to explain how that algorithm is behaving. So I know a lot of companies are not working with it, but this will come like a de facto standard for most of them.
I think that is really wise. When we are working with artificial intelligence and data and make business decisions based on that, we also should be able to explain how we got to the decision. And I think explainable AI is a really important part in the entire trustworthy AI mix. So how can we trust the decisions we have made, but how can we also trust that AI is making the right decisions?
Correct.
And you talked a bit about the regulations and you talked a bit about what you do together with Data Tilsuna. I think there's some sandboxing you are doing there.
We have a sandbox project with the Tilsuna. So we are working with the personalized journey recommendation on our app. And we want to use a lot of personal information from our users. But of course, we know that there are GDPR restrictions. So we are working with Data Tilsuna on how can we use personal information in AI algorithms. So it's a great project. We're learning a lot.
I just have to to explain what we're talking about. Data Tilsuna is the data protection authority in Norway. When we had our initial chat for the conversation, there were so many topics we wanted to talk about and so much interesting to explore. And there's another part here that I really want to spend a couple of minutes on, and that was content computing and quantum AI. What is it and how do you use it and for what purpose?
Yeah. So the reason we started looking into quantum computing, I would also like to clarify that quantum computing was, the need for quantum computing came because our data is constantly increasing. Our algorithms are becoming more complex. And we see like even now, traditional computing takes more power. It is expensive. And it takes more time to reach a specific output. So we were like, okay, we need to start looking into newer technologies and how they can help us. So quantum computing, the project we did with quantum computing was more of a research project in trying to see, is this something we can use or not? So what we did was had a partnership with OsloMet University. So they had a professor called Sergey. He was an advisor to us in this project, and he's a professor in quantum computing. And he was an advisor to us in this project, and two students worked with this one, and we we had already implemented capacity prediction using ER. So we tried to re-implement the whole thing with the same data, with the same properties using quantum computing. And we got like a quantum computing computer from Amazon Cloud. It was very cheap to actually just rent that instance. And we started using it. So the project was a success. We were able to deploy this into production. By deployment, I mean like testing it out in production, seeing how the output is, and giving it data daily to see how the model performs in actual. We learned a lot of things from this project, which was very important. And the things we learned was that quantum computing was actually cheaper to work with as compared to traditional computing. Because, you know, in traditional computing, if you have a complex problem, you have to buy one server, then you have to buy another server, then you have to think about parallel computing. Servers need to run together. You have to think about RAM, storage, and all that. In quantum computers, the only thing you have to think about is qubits. The higher the qubits, the higher the processing power. So in traditional computing, you have to work with 10 servers. In quantum computing, you only have to work with one quantum server. So the price goes down. And every time you use a traditional computer, you pay per hour. In quantum computing, you pay for per execution. So it might take a longer time, but you pay for per execution, which is half a dollar. And energy-wise, we found quantum computers to be more efficient. So that was also a sustainability part, that we finally realized that, okay, yeah, AI takes a lot of energy. You have so many servers running in and you have so much data, you have so much consumption going on. But we did some experiments and we realized that, okay, for one algorithm, which is going to run on 10 simultaneous servers with parallel computing, you are paying for a price for every server which is executing that algorithm. But you don't need 10 quantum computers. You need one quantum computer. And one quantum computer was getting electricity of 25 kilowatts. Now, a quantum computer with 100 qubits and the 500 qubits are consuming the same amount of electricity. So you just increase the qubits with the same electricity. And that means your algorithm is now running on one quantum computer instead of 10 servers. So that was a huge eye-opener. Like, quantum computers are more sustainable. There are drawbacks of quantum computers as well. We work with a small amount of data set. We had like 3.5 gigabits of data coming in. And our researchers identified that the larger the data set, the more beneficial it is because the accuracy can be more higher. So we didn't have that much data. And of course, we didn't have a lot of libraries for quantum computing. But that was another thing we learned from this project. So right now, quantum computing is it's not a technology everyone can use. But if we go in this direction, this is so much beneficial for the environment. It's more sustainable to work with. It costs less and it gives you more power by doing that as well. So Ruther is interested in this technology. We have a team working with quantum computing purely on the research and development side. And we have received a lot of interest from research organizations who want to partner up and continue working because we have the actual use cases and they can actually combine the research part with our development part.
That's fantastic. And it goes a bit, I had a chat with data centers and sustainability on an earlier episode. We talked exactly about that the more data you're processing, the more energy you're consuming, and that will calculate to something exactly.
Yep.
So we're already at the end of it, and that was a great conversation. We talked a lot about sustainability. We talked about how Ruther is working with AI to enable us to reduce traffic in Oslo, enable us to get an environmentally friendly transport system. So I'm really happy. That was a great talk. Yep. Thank you. Is there anything you want to sum up with, any key takeaways, or do you have a call to action?
Yeah, a call to action, yes. I think we get this question a lot by a lot of people and companies who want to start working with AI. And the question is very similar, like, how should they start with this? For us also, it was a very small step. We started 3 years ago. We didn't have any use cases. We started looking for a use case. And my advice will be that start small, look around you, the problems you can solve, and focus on how you can provide the full value addition to your users. Don't work on books and take it all the way to an integration part, integrate it all the way, and then think about the product mentality, how you can make sure that an AI algorithm is actually a product which keeps on serving its purpose. It's not dead after 3 months. It will keep on living through its life. Yeah. So that was my key takeaway.
What a fantastic way to sum it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was very nice to talk to you.